evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, February 9, 2015. U.S. diplomat in South Sudan is calling on the warring parties to broker a deal and end the fighting.
But this was something that the South Sudanese leadership writ large and the SPLM as the political party, more specifically, had complete control over. It did not have to spill into actual physical violence.
And the rebels and government forces accuse each other of attacks in Upper Nile and Unity States.
First is an attack on Wankai in Unity State. And Wankai is in Mayom County, south of Mayom County. It was attacked yesterday morning, and the SPLM forces have repulsed that attack. The second violation is shelling and bombardment using artillery and mortars on SPLM position in Nasir.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United States, United Kingdom, and Norway say they are deeply disappointed at the failure of President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to reach a deal at the talks in Addis Ababa that ended a week ago. Mr. Kiir and Machar did sign a power-sharing agreement a week ago today, but a peace deal remains elusive. The three countries make up the troika for South Sudan. They released a statement on Friday saying the deal reached in Addis Ababa is only a partial agreement and they are disappointed that Mr. Kiir and Machar, quote, failed to achieve significant progress towards a peace agreement. The troika members called on the two parties in South Sudan's conflict to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement. And they say both sides have to work hard and agree on the structure of a transitional government of national unity by July 1st. The troika also called on the African Union to make public findings of a report on human rights violations during the crisis in South Sudan. The African Union's Peace and Security Council commissioned the report last year, but decided late last month to not to release it until a peace deal for South Sudan has been reached. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, who headed the team that put together the report, told Human Rights Commission in September that he has no doubt that there has been gross violations of human rights in South Sudan and that they have been committed by both sides in the conflict. Meanwhile, a senior UN official and a Hollywood actor who is a special envoy for the world body are adding their voices to the growing call for a quick end to the South Sudan's conflict. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, and UNESCO Special Envoy for Peace and Reconciliation, Forrest Whitaker, who is an award-winning actor, say unless this peace is restored quickly, South Sudan is looking at a bleak future. Charlton Doki has this report from Juba.
It's heartrending to see the suffering of the people. This is a country which is rich in talent and rich in resources. If this conflict continues, we will see a generation of South Sudan's children who are lost.
I joined the USG Amison calling on all parties to the conflict to put down their arms and work together towards building a sustainable peace for the people of South Sudan.
Valerie Amos and Forrest Whitaker met with officials, including President Salva Kiir, with foreign ambassadors and with aid workers during their three-day visit to South Sudan. They also spent time in camps for internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in Juba and Jonglei State. Amos says what she takes away from the visit is that
people are desperate for peace, and they're tired of living in fear. Many had had to flee several times. They had fled their homes, gone elsewhere, and then had to flee again. They were exhausted. They lack water. They're extremely worried for their children. Sexual violence is rife. All the people that we spoke to want to live in safety, security, and stability.
Amos and Whitaker say that South Sudan's leaders should go to the IDP camps and see for themselves the hardship that the conflict is forcing people to endure. That might be the push that's needed for them to finally make peace, they say. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, says 2 million South Sudanese have fled their homes. Most are displaced inside South Sudan, but around 500,000 have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Around 100,000 are in camps for the displaced in South Sudan. But the people who have been forced from their homes are just more than numbers, Amos says. These are human lives that are on the brink, she says. South Sudan's leaders need to do something and do it fast.
We have 2.5 million people who urgently need help with food. It's also important to avert a further deterioration of the humanitarian situation in the country. There are thousands of children who are suffering from malnutrition, and the threat of hunger and disease is real.
Amos says humanitarian workers are trying their best to alleviate the suffering of the South Sudanese people, but they face obstacles and security risks as they try to deliver help.
13 humanitarian workers have lost their lives since the conflict began. Many face the fear of kidnapping and have seen their supplies and equipment looted. We are also seeing a worrying trend, which is on the ground, roadblocks just being suddenly established and demands being made of humanitarian workers that they pay to enable the convoys to go through. This is a reflection of the fact that the command and control mechanisms that should exist are breaking down.
Amos says she is also concerned that a South Sudanese employee of the UN's World Food Programme is still missing 4 months after he was abducted by unidentified gunmen when he was waiting in line to board a plane at the airport in Malakal. Amos says she fears for the future of South Sudan if the conflict is allowed to go on much longer.
If the economic stagnation is not addressed, development and support, which is essential for sectors like health and education, cannot be sustained.
The visit was the second by Amos and UNESCO Special Envoy Whitaker to South Sudan since the conflict began here in December 2013. Whitaker says he and Amos saw a great deal of suffering during both visits to South Sudan. He says he is particularly disturbed by the conditions faced by millions of South Sudanese children.
At the Protection of Civilians camp, I visited a few months ago in Bintiu, and I visited yesterday in Wei. We saw many children, boys and girls, suffering from malnutrition. Throughout the country, hundreds of schools remain empty, and some have been turned into military camps, as thousands of young people go without food, without education.
President Kiir and his arch-rival in the conflict, former Vice President Riek Machar, reached a power-sharing deal at talks last month in Addis Ababa, but a peace agreement still has to be hammered out. East African Bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, which has been trying for more than a year to broker peace in South Sudan, has given Mr. Kiir and Machar until March 5th to reach a final peace deal. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
After their tour of South Sudan, Amos and Whitaker traveled to Nairobi, where they appeared at a similar event with former U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, Susan Page. Ambassador Page reiterated that United States, United Kingdom, and Norway are frustrated because what happened in South Sudan is a man-made crisis.
There are other countries that are in crisis, whether it's humanitarian or other crises, that have been caused by an event like a tsunami, an earthquake, a hurricane, things that they had no control over. But this was something that the South Sudanese leadership writ large and the SPLM as the political party more specifically had complete control over. It did not have to spill into actual physical violence that has resulted in a complete uprooting of large parts of the population.
Asked if the U.S. will place further sanctions on the two warring parties, Page pointed out that the President Obama issued an executive order last April which sanctioned 4 people.
We have sanctioned 4 military leaders, 2 from each side, under that executive order. It results in travel bans, freezing of their assets in the United States, and it's shaming. It's a shameful act.
Page says the European Union and Canada has also put sanctions on some individuals. She says the U.S. is working with the United Nations Security Council on a sanction package.
What we think is really important, though, is that the region which has the most influence over the parties, because, frankly, most of the assets that the South Sudanese people and their leadership have are in the region, Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, and that's not happening.
Page says the U.S. is considering a number of options if the two sides fail to reach a deal in March, including an arms embargo, but she is not privy to direct negotiations on the topic. Ambassador Susan Page is the former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. She currently works in the office of U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. The leaders of government and rebel forces are accusing each other of violating the most recent ceasefire agreement. As Mungume Debs Rakarenji reports from Juba, the spokesperson for the government army is also accusing IGAD of failing to monitor the situation.
SPLOA spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer says there were two separate attacks on government positions this past weekend.
First is an attack on Wankai in Unity State. And Wankai is in Mayom County, south of Mayom County. It was attacked yesterday morning, and the SPLA forces have repulsed that attack. The second violation is shelling and bombardment using artillery and mortars on SPLA position in Nasir.
Colonel Aguer says there were no casualties in Upper Nile's Nasir, but says he's not able to confirm the number of casualties in Wankai because of poor communication networks in the area. He insists Machar must do a better job of monitoring the military actions of his forces on the ground and accuses IGAD of relying far too much on second-hand information.
This is why every time when there is an attack on SPLA position, they tend to blame equally both sides. They should convince Riek Machar to bring their officers on board so that they are part of the monitoring like the SPLA officers. Whenever there is any violation, they should visit the area alongside officers that are from both sides.
Human rights groups in South Sudan say both sides have repeatedly violated ceasefire agreements within days of signing those agreements. Kano Agueri wonders whether Machar has absolute control over all rebel forces.
If Riek is in command, then why should they continue bombarding Nasir, which is near to his headquarters in Fagag? And if he is in command of those forces in Bentiu, why are they attacking SPLA from time to time?
The United States, the United Kingdom and Norway released a joint statement today saying, quote, "We are profoundly disappointed by South Sudan's leaders' failure to reach a comprehensive peace deal at recent talks," end quote. The three-government alliance, which refers itself as the Troika, is urging President Kiir and Machar to return to negotiating table in Addis Ababa and be prepared to compromise in order to reach a deal by March 5th. The date by which both leaders have agreed to conclude a comprehensive peace agreement to end the crisis. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
South Sudan in Focus could not reach the rebels for comments on this story. South Sudanese officials announced today that the country's overall daily oil production has increased for the first time since conflict forced wells to close in Unity State and reduce the output in the neighboring Upper Nile State. However, South Sudan's Minister of Petroleum and Mining warns that oil production has not resumed in Unity State because of damages to facilities caused by more than a year of fighting. Philip Thona Leu has more for VOA from Juba.
Petroleum and Mining Minister Stephen Diu Dao says oil output is up because security in Upper Nile State has been improving in recent months, allowing oil companies to produce more barrels each day. He told reporters in Juba today the country is producing an additional 8,000 barrels each day.
The production has increased from 160,000 barrels a day to around 168,000 barrels a day. That is in Upper Nile, of course.
But Dow says production remains close in Unity State, the site of fierce battles when the conflict erupted in December 2013. Oil fields have changed hands between government and rebel forces several times since that time. Dow says the government is now in full control of all oil fields in Unity State, but foreign oil workers have yet to return.
When the full security and the peace comes to that area, they will be called back to prepare for the commissioning. They will fix, of course, there is some little destruction that took place when the rebel attacked the site of that refinery. We do not have an assessment as we speak. It needs a time.
Dow says the oil facilities in Unity State have been cleared of grass to prevent bushfires from causing any further damage. Back in December 2013, South Sudan was producing up to 240,000 barrels per day, according to the Ministry of Petroleum and Mining. That dropped to 160,000 barrels a day when oil fields were closed in Unity State and production had to be significantly reduced in Upper Nile due to insecurity in the area. The dramatic reduction in national oil production, along with lower prices for crude on the global market, has left the government of South Sudan struggling to pay its bill. Roughly 98% of South Sudan revenues come directly from oil sales. For BOA News, I am Philipton Aleu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, security officials prevent lawyers from selecting their leaders in Juba and Wau. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the best advice you got from your mother?
A quick intervention when there is a problem. My mom used to tell me that I have to intervene very quickly, immediately, when there is a problem, either a family problem or a community problem where I have the concern.
To preserve myself as a lady so that I can stay away from trouble. The other second advice that she gives me, never stop to pray and never stop being faithful to God. Like, you know, prayer life, I would recommend that.
The best advice I got from my mother is to always be a good boy. Whatever others say, I should not mind what they say. I should just be a good boy. That's the best advice.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Lawyers around South Sudan were supposed to choose a new leader of their bar association today, but reports say the National Security Service has prevented the elections from going ahead and have even arrested some lawyers who tried to vote. Jacob Wall says lawyers in Wau were about to start elections when they got a message from national security officials that the vote would not be allowed to go ahead. The lawyers quickly formed a committee to negotiate with the security services. The process of electing lawyers bar association, Wall says, is not against the national interests of the country, and it is something done in to interfere with the national security, but it is constitutional right for us to choose our leaders, he says. Wall says the vote poses absolutely no threat to security in South Sudan, and it is the constitutional right of lawyers to elect a new leader to their bar association. The National Security Service should understand that respect, should understand and respect the lawyers' right and let them vote, he says. Wall is one of the 16 lawyers in Wau who were expected to participate in the election today. He says undemocratic appointment should be a thing of the past in South Sudan. He says everyone should be able to choose their leader without outside pressure. This is the first time South Sudanese lawyers are voting or trying to vote for a president of their bar association. VOA fellow Michael Atit prepared that report in Washington. Now we are turning to Kenya. The aid organization Concern Worldwide says rising food prices and lack of employment in Kenya's slum areas have pushed an already desperate people into extreme poverty. The organization blames the Kenyan government for ignoring the plight of hundreds of thousands of slum residents in Nairobi. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports.
Kenya's 2009 census shows more than 3 million people leaving the capital, Nairobi. And of that number, two-thirds reside in slum areas where unemployment is high. People struggle to feed their families and lack basics like running water, electricity and proper drainage systems. Concerned Worldwide's country director, Wendy Erasmus, says Kenya's standard for defining an emergency fits rural areas but not urban ones.
So in Kenya we use a number of indicators that were mainly developed around a rural context. So they look at things like crude mortality, acute malnutrition, dietary diversity and coping strategies. Here in the urban setting, what we find is not only are the indicators slightly different, but the thresholds that require a response are also likely to be very different.
Over the years, the Kenyan government, with the help of humanitarian agencies, has scaled up its operation in providing food, water and medical aid to the people of rural areas, especially the drought-stricken north. According to Concern Worldwide, people living in slum areas are not getting attention and help like residents of other areas. The organization blames the policies of the government. Erasmus says with more people immigrating to Nairobi in search of better job opportunities, more attention has to be paid to such individuals.
We need to realize that in the future, most people are living in an urban context, and that's where the emergencies are going to have the biggest impact. We also need to recognize that urban emergencies are different, and because they're different, we need to institute a crisis management and contingency fund for the urban context.
Concern Worldwide says some families in slum areas resort to what it calls negative coping strategies for short-term survival. Those strategies include relying on loans for basic commodities, withdrawing children from school, transactional sex by women and their older female children, and both petty and serious crimes. In January, President Uhuru Kenyatta launched three projects to upgrade slums. The government employed more than 3,000 youths to participate in cleanup programs and road construction. Mr. Kenyatta said it was unfortunate that in the past, development and government projects favoured other areas. Reverend Gideon Nzioki in Korogocho Slum, one of the areas getting a facelift, knows the changes that are taking place, but says that many residents are still going hungry.
The government need to intervene to these emergencies, because if somebody, people, they have no food, the government need to come up. Like now this time, the inflation is too high and they cannot afford. The government need to come in and support the community.
The Kenyatta government insists it's willing and ready to improve the lives of people living in urban settings, but it will need more time to reach and cater for the needs of such people after decades of neglect by previous administrations. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Fighters with Nigeria's Boko Haram militants attacked a prison in Niger today, their third cross-border attack in the past 4 days. Witnesses and military sources say Niger's army repelled the attack in the southeastern town of Diffa after several hours of overnight fighting. It was not immediately clear how many people were killed or wounded or whether any prisoners escaped. Goalkeeper Boubacar Barry saved and scored the crucial spot kicks that gave Ivory Coast the win in a dramatic 9-8 penalty shootout over Ghana in the Africa Cup of Nations final. Barry, who appeared to cramp up during the shootout, denied fellow keeper Brima Razak one of five efforts missed before the winning kick. It's the second title for Ivory Coast and a repeat of the 1992 final. And finally, at least 22 soccer fans were killed and many more injured when police and supporters clashed at a football game in Cairo, local media report. The clash happened at a match between two Cairo clubs. The Interior Ministry said in a statement that huge numbers of Zamalek Club fans tried to storm the stadium gates by force. Authorities say police used tear gas to disperse the crowd. The death toll is expected to rise. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
And now we move to Nigeria. The decision to postpone Nigeria's elections by 6 weeks has met with criticism at home and abroad. Voters in Nigeria say they are disappointed. VOA's Anne Look has the story from Abuja.
Nigeria's Electoral Commission says it pushed back the February 14th and February 28th polls because security agencies say they cannot secure voting and need more time to fight Boko Haram in the northeast. That claim has been met with a fair bit of skepticism from voters.
6 weeks to end insurgency when they have taken a whole 5 years, they have not been able to deal with it. It will not change anything, and they are just postponing the inevitable.
Boko Haram militants control large swaths of territory and are threatening the Borno state capital, Maiduguri. Regional troops began deploying last month as the conflict spilled over the borders. But many voters think this delay is about politics, not security. Recent polls show the ruling PDP party neck and neck with main opposition party, the APC. It's the PDP's first major challenge since coming to power in 1999.
And we know APC wants the election to hold. PDP is buying time. I feel our leaders are playing politics with the system, which is so unfortunate. But we get it right at the end of the day.
Three court cases have been filed to try to disqualify APC presidential candidate Muhammadu Buhari. Buhari has called for calm. His supporters say they are confident.
No matter how the election is being postponed, we're still going to come out and vote for our right because we are sick and tired of this government. All we need is change.
The government denies the delay is politically motivated and says the security and logistical challenges are real. About 35% of voters still need to pick up their voter cards, for example. Some voters say the 6 week postponement is okay if it means more people get to vote and that candidates are less likely to contest results.
We are not looking at the 6 week alone, but we were looking at the perfection of the election, which is more important.
The Electoral Commission insisted that it was ready to hold credible polls on February 14th, but says it will make good use of the extra time. Anne Look, VOA News, Abuja.
And that report from Abuja brings us to the end of our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Hasada Maakok by Isaac Number One. Isaac Number One.
Finas mazu kele hayata nasi sala. Umon mazu kele hayata kidego. Umon mazu kele hayata kizala. Umon mazu kele hayata kidego. Umon mazu kele hayata kizala. Yes, amen.
We have been listening to Isaka Number One with that song Hasada Maako. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.